Thanks, Anne. My name is Linda. I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Billy for inviting me. It is an honor and a privilege to tell my story such as it is. I'm grateful to be sober today. And, you know, in keeping with the primary purpose, I love sharing what it took to get here and what it takes to stay here. Thank you so much. I'm going to do that. Actually, I need to get this here. Anyway, my sobriety date is June the 9th, 2005. My home group is A Vision for You in Charlottesville, and we have two meetings a week, one on Wednesdays at 7:30 at the Salvation Army and one on Saturday afternoons, Hinton Avenue United Methodist. One is a big book, that's at noon, and one is a big book. The big book study is Wednesday, and the step meeting is on Saturday. And once a month we do a tradition, just because. Anyway, I have a sponsor, and I sponsor women, and I have worked the 12 steps. And so my story about what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now kind of starts just briefly. You know, I kind of came into the world backwards. I came into the world feet first. And I feel like I've been going backwards ever since, up until the last few years. It took getting sober to right-size me. What I remember from my childhood is feeling very, very small and very, very scared. I remember, there is alcoholism in my family. In my immediate family as well as my extended family. I don't necessarily think that that's what makes me an alcoholic, but it's there. And because it's there, I grew up with a lot of volatility, a lot of unpredictability. I never knew from one minute to the next what was going to set my father off and what he was going to do to deal with whatever set him off a lot of times. And so I learned really early, we didn't know what feelings were. We weren't allowed to express them. We really needed to stay out of sight is pretty much how it worked in our family. And I learned at a very early age how to hide, standing in the center of the room. And that's how I survived. So I remember that. We grew up, my grandparents were immigrants. There was free-flowing wine at Sunday dinners, even for the children. We each had a special glass. I always thought that was a pretty cool thing, although I didn't like the taste of it. And I don't know. It was just really hard growing up in our house, being pushed down, being scared all the time, and just hiding. And over time, that kind of thing just builds. It got to a point that really I didn't know where I was and where everyone else started. Because one of the ways that I got along, besides hiding, this was before I found alcohol, one of the ways that I got along, besides hiding, was to be whoever you wanted me to be. You told me who I was and what I was and how to act and what to say and what decisions I was going to make. And that's pretty much describes my entire life, even long after I picked up a drink. That's how it was. My parents, God love them, did the best that they could do, the best that they knew how. They could only do what they knew. And they loved me in the best way that they could love me, but it just, you know, it did a lot to squash my spirit, whatever my spirit was. I am actually looking for, and there's a solution. There was a description that I marked about my alcoholism. The first memory I have of alcohol changing who I was at the time was when I was 16 on a class trip to New York City. And at that time, in 1971, you could the drinking age was 18, and you could go into a restaurant or bar and order a drink. And I was with other people who were of age, even though I was 16 at the time. And so I remember getting drunk on sangria in Mama Leone's. And it tasted great, it made me feel great, and whatever things go on in my head, whatever things I was hiding from or afraid of or running from, all went away with a couple of sips of that first drink. I mean, and it was like that for a really long time. A guy that I went to high school, a guy that I had gone to school with all through my life, who knew me from church and knew me from school, rode back on the bus trip with me that night. And at the end of the trip, he just looked at me and he's like, "Linda, you know, I've known you our entire lives, and I've never heard you talk more than, in all that time, I've never heard you talk more than you did on this 2-hour ride home." So, I mean, alcohol did things for me that I could not imagine. So that was the first time. And then the second time, I didn't continue to drink, but man, I remembered exactly how that felt. And that was something I was going to be looking for whenever I had a chance. It turned out that my chance didn't come for another year and a half when I left my parents' home to go away to school. And my first weekend there, went to a kegger on campus and in the woods and had some beer, and it was like magic. Same thing. Whatever anxieties were in my head, whatever fears about who I was, I'm not smart enough, I'm not pretty enough, I don't make enough money, I'm not this, I'm not that, on and on and on and on. Away. Like that. Problem with it is, I didn't stop. I didn't stop with a couple of pitchers of sangria. I didn't stop with one beer. I took it as far as it would go, which meant that night meant blackout, and I woke up with someone hurting me, and I had no memory of it. I didn't remember if I remembered agreeing to go watch television with somebody, and I ended up somewhere in the basement of the boys' dorm. Anyway, and as bad as that was in some ways, that didn't stop me. I mean, I went after that feeling I found a new toy. I found a new something outside of myself. One of the things growing up is I was constantly looking for an escape, something outside of me that was going to make me feel okay inside. The reason things were so bad in my house growing up, this is in my mind, is because there was something wrong with me. And I looked for that and looked for that and looked for that any way that I could. And really, alcohol became my friend that way, because when I drank, I had no cares. I was enough, whatever that was at the time. And so it continued. I mean, the stories are that I did really poorly that semester and was asked not to come back until I could prove that I could keep my grades up. I was thinking about this today. I went to a meeting this morning on powerlessness, and it really kind of brought me back to some of the things that I used to do. I have always since the time I was 15, and really before that, if you count babysitting, I have always had a job and never had two nickels to rub together. I have nothing to show for it because once I got to a certain point in my life, every cent that I made went to partying and making myself feel good with a bottle or bottles. I got it any way I could. And the thing was that I didn't drink every single day. I don't know if that's controlled. I can stand here and look back and talk about controlled drinking that they talk about in chapter 3, I think it is. And I did those things. I did not know for a long time that alcohol was my problem. I always wondered. I always had a lot of nights where morning afters, really, where I would say, whoa, never again, never again. And so my drinking was concentrated over a period of days. So I would drink for days at a time, and then I would stop for days at a time. And always I was thinking about the next time I was going to be drinking. It always got planned out. I knew who was going to be there. I knew what drink I was going to have. And that depended on what restaurant or bar I was at. I knew what was going to lead up to all of that. I knew how it was going to feel after the first sip. Problem is, I didn't know what was going to happen after the first sip. That's what makes me an alcoholic. I might be able to go for days or weeks. And one point in time in my life, I went for 2 years without drinking. But I always went back. And once I started, I couldn't stop. And it was always more and more and more and more. And when I drank at the beginning to feel okay with myself, I was happy. I wasn't a mean drunk. I felt good when I drank. I was euphoric. I was higher than high can be. And that lasted, too, for a really long time. However, it gets a little messier as time goes on. That's the other thing. It was great. I can't tell you in years how long it was great, but it was great. And I was always looking for the thing that I got that first time, the really feeling good, the really being happy. And it was always depressing at the end. And in the middle of my drinking, what happened was, you know, there were more and more sort of personal consequences. The idea that I didn't have money, I couldn't make my bills, or I didn't care about paying my bills. I thought about having the drink, and a lot of days it was the choice between paying the electric bill and planning to go out with my friends. And I was one of those people. I drank anything and everything. I mean, I didn't have any particular drink. I wasn't a snob that way. I mean, I did beer, I did wine, I did kamikazes, I did wild turkey. I had a wild turkey phase. Martinis. I mean, you name it. I'm an equal opportunity alcoholic. There was nothing I ever turned away in that respect. But in the middle of my drinking, there were consequences like that. No money, bills not getting paid, I've had the electric and the phone turned off lots of times, would always come up with an excuse. Because, see, I looked okay on the outside. Always had a job from the time I was 15. I had responsible jobs, too, a big chunk of that time. I eventually got to nursing school and finished nursing school despite myself. Despite myself. And so I had really responsible jobs, and I made a fair living, but never had anything to show. Lots of inappropriate relationships, doing lots of things over and over and over again, things that I never thought I would do, and then having done them, said never again. So let me just tell you quick. It's hard to narrow it down to three stories. I told you the first story, the first time I got drunk, the second time I got drunk and blacked out. I was always looking for a way to get around. I was very sneaky. I seemed very sweet on the surface. I seemed very quiet. I didn't cause a lot of trouble. That was one way of hiding who I am. But I didn't have enough money to go partying one week, and I stole a check from my sister. I didn't steal it from the top of the checkbook or the back of the checkbook, but right in the middle, because it would take her a while to figure out what had happened. I made the check out to me by forging her handwriting, and I forged her name in the signature box. And I actually got away with it for a while, but my sister, unfortunately, was very good about keeping a register, and she knew she didn't write that check. And it wasn't even for a huge amount. Like, I didn't go whole hog. I just took enough. I want to say it was maybe $30, if that. I just took enough. And then it just progressed. I remember one time teaching a workshop. A colleague had asked me to talk to some of his therapists about a particular thing. And I did a workshop, and it was well known that I was in my wild turkey phase. And my honorarium for doing that little workshop was a bottle of wild turkey. So whatever I presented here, however professionally I looked, I mean, people knew things about me. I wasn't very nice. As long as one of the ways my disease comes up, well, it's all in character defects, but I have this thing with perfection going on and achievement and superiority, and I'm smarter than you, so I know what's right for you. And if you're going to come to me with your problems, you better darn well listen to me because I have the answers. All of that. And a lot of that filtered into, I ended up working in intensive care units, which, for anybody who knows, is very dramatic and very chaotic. And let me tell you, I put the DQ in drama queen and the K in chaos. And let me tell you, when there's a problem, you better get out of my way, because I'm going to solve it. And I remember one time, I wasn't drinking at work, but one of my jobs was to train people to work in our unit. And there was a woman that I had decided did not belong there, and I was going to prove it. And over a 3-day period, I proceeded to run that poor woman into the ground, and she ended up leaving. And to this day, I'm so ashamed of that act, because I remember I set out to make her fail. Wow, I just got emotional about that. I'm remembering it. She may not have belonged there in the long run, but it wasn't my job to make her see that. So those were some of the ways that my disease... And the thing is, working in an intensive care unit where things are fast-paced and there's a lot of drama and everything is life and death, the extremes, the ultimate extreme, that just fed... It just fueled everything for me. So that by the end, okay, we're getting to the end. I'm trying to keep track of the time. Oh, good. A couple minutes. By the end, here's what I was doing. I was drinking to go out to be with people that I wanted to be with. It was a badge of honor to be able to drink them under the table. But I had to show up drunk to do it. I did whatever I did when I was out and about, usually trying to one up. I would come home and I would drink. And then if I managed to get to sleep, I would wake up depressed. And I would not get out of bed for days. The thing about my job was I was able to I would work for 3 days at a time, or sometimes four. It just depended. But about three at a time, and then I'd be off for 3 or 4 days. And that's when it all hit the fan. And so nobody was going to come looking for me unless I didn't show up for work in 4 days' time. But I had the luxury of not opening the blinds, not answering the phone, not getting out of bed, not changing my clothes, not washing, not brushing teeth, hair, all of the stuff. All the things all of us have done. I just basically hid out. And it got to the point where my friend would call me. She'd get really angry at me, and she would call me on the phone. She'd pull up to my house. My car was in the drive. She'd yell at me over my machine saying, "I know you're in there. Pick up your phone. You're not going anywhere. Blah, 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 blah. Stop it." So I fixed her, took my car, parked it somewhere else, walked home, and I could be left alone to do whatever I, to be in my little pity pot, whatever. Whatever I was doing, to be able to drink, to be able to sit in my juices, stew in my juices. And that's kind of how it was at the end. One of the other ways that my disease shows up, well, I mentioned it already actually, is I'm going to fix you. And as long as I'm distracted by what's going on with you and what your issues are, I don't have to look at me and what my issues are. My brother was very, very, very sick from his disease. And that's the thing that got me, you know, out of myself. It's interesting because that theme follows through with the rest of what I'm going to say. But I ended up in AA because I was trying to fix my brother. I'd been going to Al-Anon for a little bit. I didn't get it. I didn't belong there, but I didn't get it. And it was like, as a result of an Al-Anon meeting, I ended up in an AA meeting. And what I knew, I didn't know alcohol was my problem. And truthfully, I hadn't looked at myself long enough for any period of time. I was always reaching for something outside. I was always reaching for a drink to feel better. I thought the newest self-help book would be good. A personal growth seminar, because then I could really get in touch with myself. New therapist. Maybe some new medication. I don't know. I don't know what the answer was, but I was always reaching outside. Meantime, every time I reached for something else, whatever part of me that I started with just slowly was dying off. Dying off, dying off. And so I didn't hear a whole lot at the beginning. I came to meetings for a few months. I didn't stop drinking because alcohol was not my problem. But what I kept going back to was unmanageability. And eventually what happened for me is I came to the first step a little backwards, the way I kind of came into the world, but I got there. And I realized that this is my problem. Alcohol is my problem. And I do not have control. That is the one thing I don't have a choice over. And I took my first step. And it's funny how that happened, because all of a sudden, I wasn't worried about my brother anymore. I was worried, but I realized I couldn't save him. It took me a while, but I, as with many things in recovery and sobriety, it took me a while, but I got here. And my point with bringing that up is that it takes what it takes for everybody. I've been blessed. I don't know if I've been blessed. I don't have the experience of relapse. That's where I'm going. One of the things that I heard, I can't put it all together because I have a lot of lapses. It took me a long time to really kind of get honest. Like, I knew certain things were true about me, but my path in sobriety has definitely not been linear. I mean, it has been this and that and back this many steps, you know, I'm all over the place. But I haven't had to take another drink. I heard early on to keep coming back. My first sponsor would say to me frequently when I would go to her with a problem, you're right where you're supposed to be. I did not want to hear that. I did not want to hear that feeling miserable was right where I was supposed to be. She also had the wisdom to say to me that relapse does not start when you pick up the drink. It starts long before that. And trust me, I have a history of living in my head and thoughts that would scare you to death to know that that's true. I'm very, very sneaky. I don't know if any of you can relate to that. But let's see. So that's kind of how I got here. I really want to talk a lot about, I wanted to talk mostly about the solution, because there is one, and it isn't mine. I will tell you that I didn't have such a bad time my first year sober. I felt pretty good early on. I'm not sure what that was about. My reason for mentioning that is it's not the same. I definitely at the beginning wanted to compare out, and I still want to compare out. I want to think that, you know, just like I thought my story wasn't as bad as yours because I didn't end up in jail or jobless or homeless or in an asylum, that you know, maybe I was missing something or you had something that I didn't. It's constantly been that for me. But what I know about that is that on the outside, we all look different. The details of our stories are different. But on the inside is where we're all the same. And when I hear you talk, regardless of what got you to this moment, coming into the rooms for the first time, I relate. It doesn't matter who you are, how old you are, how long you've been here, or where you've been. I know exactly what you're talking about. It took me a while to learn that. I used to want to apologize for my story not being as bad as some. I mean the thinking, okay? Again, the disease we believe is centered in the mind. I cannot stress that enough. The solution, okay. While I don't have a choice, I heard this morning too. I heard a lot of great stuff this morning. One thing I will say to you is I am grateful to say I've not had an original thought in the last 3 years since getting sober. Because everything that I know today, I know because you told me, and you taught me, and you showed me. I don't have a solution on my own, and I cannot stay sober on my own. And for somebody who was very tied up in how things look on the outside, and the perfection and doing things to the nth degree, I can stand before you saying that I have only done one thing perfectly in sobriety, and that is not to drink. And that's where it starts. It's as simple as that. This is life and death for me. I had chapters marked in the book, and I can't find them now because I'm too nervous, so I'm not going to read them. You guys have read them over and over and over. Here's the thing. This is life and death. For me, today, to drink is to die. And I have no doubt if I had continued on the path, you know, that I would be well on my way to death, an institution, or jail. Because there's enough evidence when I look at my inventory to say that beyond the shadow of a doubt for me. So I'm really grateful to be here. And the other thing I want to say about higher power, I want to say something about higher power. This is a spiritual solution, this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is the only thing that has been found to help us recover from this disease. And I firmly believe that. And I grew up a Catholic. I grew up with religion. Spirituality, I was spiritually and emotionally dead and on my way to physically dying when I walked in here. I was dead inside. I might as well have been physically dead on the outside. This is a spiritual program of recovery. Everything we do is spiritual. And it has nothing to do with a religious God, and it has nothing to do with the beauty. I grew up with nuns and being slapped and hit with rulers and all these rules of my Catholic Church, and that's what I thought God was, and praying a specific way for things that I wanted and I needed because I deserved them. That's not how it works. In sobriety, in recovery, I had to make contact with a higher power. What I know is that I'm here today because something outside of me brought me here. I actually choose to call my higher power God, but it's not the God of my youth and my religion. The beauty is I get to decide what that thing greater than me is. Some people call it the universe. Some people call it God. Some people call it their creator. Anyone who ends up here has to agree that they're not here on their own. I want to believe. I still want to believe I can do this by myself. I have tried, but I can't. And so one of the big things, so I'm going to refer to my higher power as God, and I just wanted you to know that if I respect the fact if you don't call yours God, I respect the fact whatever your higher power is for you, as long as you've got one, that's all that matters to me. But I call my higher power God. So coming in, I had the first contact with my higher power through all of you because you told me how you were, and you made suggestions to me to make my life, to make me be a better human being, a normal human being, if I can be normal. You helped me at the beginning, and you still do today, to slow down the things in my head. So I have to come to meetings. I wanted to share with you, this is how self-centered and how superior I think I am. I actually bought my big book at Barnes & Noble because I was going to be darned if I was going to ask you for help. That's another way that my disease shows up. Lord knows you cannot know what the answer is for me. And as sort of willing as I was sort of willing at the beginning, but I didn't want you to know how bad I felt, and so I didn't want you to know that I didn't know. And so instead of raising my hand at a meeting and saying, you know, I'm having a problem, I need a book, I need a sponsor, none of that stuff. I sort of did it in my sneaky little convoluted way. Went to Barnes & Noble and said, I'm going to get that book and see what it's about. Well, I didn't understand a lick, which is as it should be. That's just another character defect. So I came to meetings, and at the beginning I went from meeting to meeting because I was really so freaked out inside and did not know how to express that and did not know how to share it. And the only thing that I knew was to keep moving. Again, the key is action. So at the beginning, I went from meeting to meeting, and I did 90 and 90 or more for a very long time, and that's important to me today. I have to do meetings. I have, we're talking about basics here because this is not rocket science, and it isn't the huge things that it's going to take me out. It's going to be the shoestring break-in, the day-to-day little things. I do at least 4 to 6 meetings a week and 4 to 7 meetings a week, sometimes more. If there's something going on with me, I'm more than likely apt to do more meetings. At least 4 to 5 of those meetings are committed meetings where people see me on a regular basis. I told you one of the things that I do is hide, and that didn't change when I got sober. The difference now is I do less isolating. I still want to run away. And one of the reasons, one of the things, this is the beauty of doing what we do in this program, is that if we are going to committed meetings, people get to know us. We're less likely able to hide, which means we're more likely to be called on our things, whatever our thing is. You know, haven't seen you in a while. What's going on with you? Huh? What about that? What about the thing that happened the other week? How are you handling that? Where are you on your fourth step? All the stuff that's important along the road. When people get to know you, that's what happens. That leads me to the next thing, home group. Got to have one. A lot of what I did at the beginning was sort of, I fell into things. I fell into my first sponsor. I fell into my first home group, which is still my home group. I've always had a service position in my home group. As much as possible, I show up early and I stay late. And in addition to my home group, there are at least two other meetings in town where I provide specific support for opening up or closing down or just being there on a regular basis, even though I don't necessarily say I'm part of the home group. Again, the home group is important for the same reason. They're your family. They're my family in sobriety, and they get to know us just like our family. And you gotta let people know who you are, because it is too easy to isolate, and isolation will kill me. Let's see, what else? Sponsor. I talked about my sponsor. My first sponsor took me through the steps, and I used her when I needed to use her. She wasn't a woman who made demands of me, and it made it really easy. After a certain point, once I got a little further along, it was a little easier for me. You know, she didn't make demands of me, so it was easier for me to continue to direct myself. And I told myself that because I was using other women for this and that, that it was okay. But really, I would tell a piece to you, and a piece to you, and a piece to you, and nobody ever got the real picture, the big picture. Sponsor is important to my sobriety because she gets to see the whole picture with me, and it's less likely that I can stay in denial when we are talking once a week. We talk for an hour at least once a week. Sometimes more, it depends. I also sponsor women, and that is very important. That is not something I wanted to do. It is not something I thought I could do. And the first sponsee I had, she's probably about 18 months sober now, I tried very hard to talk her out of wanting me as a sponsor because I was just finishing up a fourth and fifth step. I had been in the program a couple years. I didn't think I knew what I needed to know, and on and on and on and on. But here's the thing. Part of what goes on here in terms of changing, and I have to change or I'm going to die. If I don't change, I'm going to drink again. If I drink again, I'm going to die. The same woman or man will drink again. That's something I heard early on, and that's something I believe because I have evidence all over my inventory of behavior after behavior after behavior. It had different names and different faces, but it was all the same. So, but I trust the process, and I have faith. You can call it whatever you want. It's like not knowing what the outcome is going to be. It's like doing the thing in front of me. I don't really want to do it, but you told me that it's going to help me and it's going to make me better and it's going to prepare me to be of service to somebody else who's still suffering. So if you believe it, I got to believe it, whether I do or not. And that's been a theme in my recovery. The stuff that helps me the most are the things I want to do the least. And I did not want to be a sponsor. And I tried my best not to be, but when it happened, I just said, okay, just trust the process, have faith, Maybe she won't call you. But we got to do that. We got to help somebody else. One thing that doing that does for me is it gets me out of myself. And I was told just yesterday by my sponsor, I am in my head too much. And I gotta stop that. And so one of the ways that I do that is by sponsoring other women. And I also do just general service. I mean, whatever's needed at a meeting, whether I consider myself a regular member of that meeting or not, I'm putting up chairs, I'm asking what has to be done, I am making coffee or cleaning up or talking to a newcomer, because those things get me out of myself. And those things were sort of not hammered into me, but I was gently guided early on to service as a tool. Let's see. I want to talk about gratitude. Gratitude is another thing that gets me out of my head. And I start my day with it on most days. Doesn't have to be a huge list. Five things, three things. But if you're living in the solution, which is to have gratitude, if I'm living in the solution, which is to have gratitude for where I am and what I have today, then I don't have a problem. Because if I'm not sober, I don't have a life. And I have to remember that on a daily basis. I forget it sometimes. Gratitude. Higher power. Okay, the steps. 1, 2, and 3. I can't. He can. So I'll let him. And that third one, turning it over, it's just the gateway into the action steps. And that's where you're going to get. You're changing. I found that I was changing all along. I didn't see it. Other people could. It wasn't until I really got into doing the action steps that I could at least see the change for myself. And I will tell you that it doesn't happen quickly. It doesn't look like the way I want it. It doesn't feel like the way I want it to feel. And growth for me is painful. But I don't change. I don't do something I don't want to do because I think I need to change. I do it because I feel the heat. Things get unbearable. You know, taking alcohol away from me only made things worse. Because now I had no way to, I had nothing to mask. I had nothing to numb me out. I had nothing to help me escape. And life doesn't go away when you get sober. Funny how that is. So, yeah. And sometimes, you know, I don't remember the way I used to. You know, it's weird. One of the problems I have with telling my story is that I forget a lot of it, and I forget crucial things. I spent so much time not being who I was or what I was. It's coming back to me in pieces. Like, I am learning who I am in little bits and pieces. And one of the things that I can tell you here in sobriety, I can go anywhere and I can do anything if I have a purpose. I guess I can address solution and talk to people after if they really want. All of the instructions are here in the rest of the steps. I know where I was. I was on the steps. Fourth step, very important. Got to lay that stuff out black and white. If it's in my head, I'm either better or I'm worse than I was. And I can still use that today. Okay? So I got to do a fourth step because I got to put it in black and white. If it's in black and white, I can't deny it. I can't make it bigger. I can't make it smaller. I can address it. I can see what my issues are, what my behavior was, what my motives are. And then it's not enough to write it down because I can still hide. Okay, got to tell somebody else. That's what five is about. Five keeps me honest, and it helps me not to continue to live in denial about myself. Six and seven, they're ongoing because, let's face it, they don't. I might be willing, but it doesn't all go away. I'm still pretty nasty. I still can be passive-aggressive, ask Sue on the ride up, and the traffic and the accident, and people were not moving fast enough. Did they not know I had to be somewhere? Anyway, six and seven are ongoing for me. And when something's wrong in my life today, I got to look at which character defect is glaring. It's basically let go of what I'm not supposed to do and start doing what I'm supposed to do. Eight and nine are about other people. Making the list of the people we had harmed. Number eight, that's all it is. It's a list. And it comes from your fourth step, so snap. Nine's a little harder, but that's why we need guidance. Making those amends, when to make them, how to make them, who to make them to, who not to make them to. We do not want to do further damage. But it's very important in terms of change for me and in terms of growth for me. If I don't make amends, I am going to drink again because I carried that stuff long enough, carried it around long enough to know what damage it did to me. 10, 11, and 12, you can actually start early on with the help of your sponsor. 10 is just maintenance inventory. I got to look at my part on a daily basis to stay right. A big part of this for me is being right-sized. And that's what the steps do for me. They make me right-sized. They also prepare me to help other people who are suffering. So 10's important. 11, prayer and meditation. I always had this, I have funny ideas about the way things should be, and prayer and meditation is one of those things. I've learned in sobriety that a prayer is as simple as help. Thank you. I'm grateful. That is a prayer. Meditation for me is as simple as taking a deep breath. I heard somebody remind me again last week that prayer is just talking to God, talking to your higher power, and meditation really is just listening. So I don't have to achieve a state of nirvana in order to say that I am praying and meditating. And then 12 is really working with others. All the service things that we do on a daily basis by showing up at a meeting and making sure that a meeting comes off. Saying yes when AA asks me, unless I have a good reason not to. And a good reason is another commitment generally for me. I have no good reason to say no. Because I want to is not good enough. It's important. It's important. We're here for one reason and one reason only, to stay sober and to help the other alcoholic who still suffers. I'm going to finish up because I know I'm short on time. I could talk forever. I do want to finish up by reading a section from Dr. Bob's Nightmare. I'm not going to be able to. There it is. Okay. It is a most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which I was afflicted. My health is good, and I have regained my self-respect and the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal, and my business is as good as can be expected in these uncertain times. And in sobriety, I have faced job change 3 times. I have faced medical and health issues that leave me with pain on a daily basis. My father had a stroke and his health is failing. My brother, I had some difficulties with my brother. He didn't speak to me for almost a year. And we've since made amends to each other. So those aren't, I don't see them as horrific things. Those are just challenges that I get presented with, but I haven't found the need to drink over any of them, all of which would have taken me out, all of which would have made me unreliable and inconsistent and dishonest to my family and friends who need me when they need me. And I can say today that I can show up. I am a better employee. I am a better daughter. I am a better sister and friend. I am more productive. I am more effective. I am less fearful. I'm not as dangerous as I used to be. And for that, I'm grateful. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. And in my case, it was a woman. And four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. That's all I have. I say keep coming back, and it works if you work it. Thanks so much for letting me share.